Hi, everybody. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.
Good morning. This is an NBC News special report. NBC News has learned that disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein is dead. Epstein took his own life while he was behind bars here in New York City, facing charges of sex trafficking.
In August of 2019, Jeffrey Epstein was found dead in his cell in a federal prison in Lower Manhattan. Epstein was awaiting his trial on charges of sexually abusing and trafficking dozens of minors. His death was ruled a suicide by New York City's chief medical examiner. And two federal prison guards were responsible for checking on Epstein and other inmates every 30 minutes. But instead, they were accused of sleeping and browsing the internet and admitted to falsifying records to show they'd made their rounds. Both guards were working overtime because of staffing shortages. U.S. prosecutors eventually dropped charges against the guards in 2021. Days after Epstein's suicide, then Attorney General William Barr said the events leading up to it were, quote, a perfect storm of screw-ups.
We are now learning of serious irregularities at this facility that are deeply concerning and demand a thorough investigation.
Two reporters at the Associated Press, Michael Balsamo and Michael Sisak, wanted to understand those
serious irregularities
and how the highest-profile federal inmate in decades died by suicide in one of the most secure federal prisons in the U.S. So they started digging. And what they found were not one-off offenses. Their investigation uncovered mismanagement, corruption, and abuses within the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is the Justice Department's largest law enforcement agency. They discovered widespread sexual abuse by employees who coerced inmates into silence and covered up official complaints, leadership at many levels that ignored other employee misconduct and crimes, including theft and smuggling weapons, and prisons that haven't been able to keep full staff for years, with nearly one-third of federal correctional officer positions going unfilled. Cooks, teachers, nurses, and other workers have been assigned to work as guards. And according to reporting from the Marshall Project, short staffing at the Elkton Federal Correctional Institution in Ohio forced people incarcerated at the facility to provide medical care for each other early on in the pandemic. Despite the Bureau of Prisons having an annual budget of nearly $8 billion, infrastructure in these prisons is literally crumbling. Concrete falls from ceilings, sewage pipes leak and burst. And in the wake of the Associated Press investigation, Bureau of Prisons Director Michael Carvajal announced his resignation in January. And he's still leading the agency, however, without a clear choice for a replacement. The Takeaway did reach out to the Bureau of Prisons for comment on the AP investigations, and they gave us a statement saying in part, quote, our agency is fully cooperating with the Office of the Inspector General on active investigations and will bring to justice those who abuse the public trust. The BOP remains committed to ensuring the safety of our inmates, staff, and the public. So, I still have got some questions, so let's get to them. For more, I'm joined now by Carrie Blakinger, a reporter for the Marshall Project. Her reporting has also uncovered abuse and neglect in federal prisons. Carrie is publishing a memoir in June titled Corrections in Ink, about her time as an incarcerated person. I'm also joined now by Joe Rojas, who is director of the American Federation of Government Employees Local Union Chapter for Correctional Staff in Central Florida. Joe also leads the literacy program as coordinator at the Coleman Federal Correctional Complex in Central Florida, the largest federal prison complex in the country. Joe and Carrie, thanks both for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Carrie, I just want to establish some basics. What does it mean to be in federal prison as compared to the state system?
Well, federal prison means that you've been convicted of a federal crime or that you've been accused of a federal crime. And that means that you can end up in a prison that's, you know, run by the federal government, but anywhere across the country. It's a large system and you're sometimes very far from home.
At times, Carrie, I feel like the language of federal prisoner, just like the language of felony versus misdemeanor, makes people assume that we're talking about folks who have committed the most violent kinds of crimes. And certainly starting with Jeffrey Epstein is, although he had not yet been convicted, is indicative of, I think, a sense of who federal prisoners are. But what are the types of crimes that actually tend to lead to incarceration in the federal system?
Well, 45% of federal prisoners are in for some kind of drug crime, and it's, you know, not necessarily high-level drug trafficking. Sometimes it can be minor involvement in a larger drug conspiracy, or sometimes it's, you know, relatively small amounts of drugs. And then one of the next biggest things that people are in for is about 20% are in for weapons-type offenses, which can include serious things like arson, but it can also include simply being a felon in possession of a gun, even if you didn't do anything wrong with it. So some of the offenses that can lead there can be, I think, surprisingly minor.
You know, I almost hate that I have to start with those pieces, but it does feel important, in part because we know that sometimes the general public can hear stories about these kinds of conditions and feel like, well, you know, why would that matter, right? These are violent, terrible criminals. I don't care if they're living in a difficult system or working in a difficult system. So Joe, help us to understand a bit about what the kinds of conditions we've been hearing about here mean for day-to-day life in a federal prison, whether as an incarcerated person or as someone who's staffing it?
Well, some of our prisons are old and some of our prisons are newer. The problem with the Bureau of Prisons is we have severe understaffing. And I actually put it severe in quotes because the crisis is bad. So when you have the understaffing, you can't do our programs. Like, I'm a teacher in the education department and I'm always pulled. And when you constantly have the understaffing, you can't do the programs, it does cause an issue. And it's a trickle effect that goes all the way down. So working for 27 years in the Bureau of Prisons, in my opinion, this is the worst that I've ever seen. The leadership from up top has just lost base with what it is to work inside a federal prison. It's extremely, like I said, we're extremely understaffed, and everybody suffers from the staffing to the inmates.
Carrie, so how did we get to this point? You know, Joe's saying that this is, you know, among the worst, at least, that he's ever seen. You've been reporting for quite some time, but so much of this news is really just coming out in the past year. What happened?
I mean, I think there's a few things. I do think that one of the things that has had a big effect, aside from the leadership issues that Joe mentioned, is, you know, the sort of residual effects of the pandemic. I think that we saw in a lot of prison systems during the pandemic, existing staffing issues got worse, existing problems with the conditions got worse. In a lot of places, prisoners were locked down for prolonged periods of time, sometimes, you know, for months where they were locked in their cells. And I think that this sort of exacerbated a lot of the issues that prisons already face.
Joe, can you weigh in on this a bit about how the pandemic exacerbated these conditions?
Well, it actually began with the budget cuts. I think in 2017, 2016, we lost 6,200 positions. And then right after the budget cuts, we had the shutdown. Okay, so that also affected. You had the budget cuts, then you had the shutdown. So people weren't getting paid. So a lot of people who were eligible to retire did retire instead of staying on. And then you top that off with the pandemic. So it's all equal into this, into the what we call now the crisis. So you have those three factors: the pandemic, the budget cuts, and actually also the hiring freeze. I mean, it's everything happened all at one point, all at one time, and then in 2020 or 2018, 2019, it was the pandemic. So you factor all that in, we will never recover from this. Those budget cuts, those 6,200 positions that happened, the pandemic, people are just beat down. Our staff are just beat down. The staffing, we're not getting any support from our leadership up in Washington. And actually, they exacerbate the issue by making it worse, by not helping. And there's a severe disconnect. And there's a severe disconnect from the top to the troops on the ground. You're going to get a lot of these issues. You know, the funding issues. We were supposed to be funded. Where's the money going to? Part of my job as a union is we are the whistleblowers for the public. We do expose those corrupt management officials. And if it wasn't for the union or council, you'll never know what goes on in the Bureau of Prisons.
Carrie, weigh in on this a bit for me. When we hear about corruption, I mean, we've got the AP reporting over 100 federal prison employees having been charged with committing crimes since 2019. And I'm hearing from Joe here a sense that there's some real questions about leadership as well. Can we know the true extent of these kinds of abuses, or are we simply in a situation of like a cone of silence here?
Well, you know, I think sort of it's broadly true in a lot of prison systems that we never really know, you know, how much sort of, I don't know, how much criminal behavior is happening among the staff. There was a report a number of years ago in ProPublica about the percent of staff in prisons who are actually convicted when there's evidence that they've committed a crime. And it's something like less than 1%. Now, maybe it's higher in this scenario. But, you know, even with that generous assumption, like we can still reasonably believe that the number of staff who are actually sort of committing these sorts of offenses might be much higher.
Joe, help me to understand. You've worked at Coleman for more than 25 years. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. And you're saying that you're feeling like it will never recover. What would recovery look like for you when you say never recover? What would good working conditions in a federal prison be?
It's pretty simple. It's staffing, having the proper staffing, having the amount of support staff, like having enough officers in the prisons, having enough, you know, counselors, case managers, teachers to orderly run a prison. You need the officers to keep the security, to keep, look, even inmates want to be kept safe. If you're going to do time, you want to do time safely. And then when you're incarcerated, you also want to be able to run programs, you know. Being in education for over 20 years, I've seen a lot of good. A lot of these inmates are dealing with stress. They got to deal with being incarcerated, dealing with family issues. And then, you know, they want to better themselves is through programming, whether it's through education, psychology, going through counseling groups. Right now, we don't have that. It's we're constantly pulled. If you staff our prisons the way it's supposed to be staffed, not the finagling of the numbers that you hear from central office, and the DOJ, you staff the prisons the way it's supposed to be, you're going to have a betterly, orderly running of a prison. It's staffing, staffing, staffing. That's the number one concern. And I just don't feel it's going to happen because I just think they are constantly changing the numbers to make it look like we are fully staffed when we're not.
Joe and Carrie, hold on for me just one moment. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back on this topic. Thanks for sticking with us. We're talking today about reports of widespread corruption and abuse in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I'm back now with Carrie Blakinger, a reporter at the Marshall Project, and Joe Rojas, who's worked in federal prison in Florida for 27 years and is currently the coordinator for its literacy program. All right, Carrie, I want to zoom in here on Joe's point about funding, about staffing, about programs. We've been hearing this for 50 years that we need to spend less on incarcerating people, more on public education, more on infrastructure. And yet I'm hearing from Joe that spending less on incarceration leads to circumstances where those who are incarcerated are in even worse conditions. Help me to tease this out a bit, Carrie.
I think that there's a difference between wanting a smaller prison population and actually spending less on prisons because, you know, as of now, there's so many needs that are unmet in the prison system that if, you know, we want the people who are there now to have humane conditions that will be most conducive to rehabilitation, that's frankly going to cost more money than what we're currently spending. I know this might seem counterintuitive, but I think at the start of the year when it became clear that Carvajal, the BOP director, was on his way out at some point, I started asking some prisoners what they would like to see from a new BOP director. And I think every single one of the ones that I spoke to at some point mentioned that the understaffing was negatively impacting their lives. So even the prisoners I speak to tend to say, we need more staff. It makes sense when you think about some of the things that Joe has said about how a lack of staff means that prisoners can't do some of the basic things that they need. It often means that their needs are unmet. They're not getting programming. They're not getting to do the programming that they need to qualify for early release. So, you know, some of the reasons that you might need to put more money into prisons would really be just to, in some cases, improve their chances of getting out and also to improve their chances of succeeding when they get out.
Carrie, stick with me on this for just one more, because it does feel counterintuitive. And we're looking at a budget currently of $8 billion, right? Again, it's the kind of thing that if you're forming some social and political discourse around spending too much on prisons, right, you could look right at that. If there were to be an increase in that annual budget, how would we know that it was going in ways that would actually improve conditions for workers and for the incarcerated?
Well, I do think that in many prison systems, including the federal prison system, there's been a lack of meaningful oversight. I mean, the fact that Joe has to come on here and say that his union is the whistleblower and that this is sort of some of the oversight that exists in federal prisons, that is a huge problem. I think that there's been a lack of transparency when the agency ends up in front of lawmakers. You know, I think they've sort of repeatedly made some questionable claims, and I think that there's consistently been an issue with lawmakers not being able to get answers out of them. They'll, you know, send questions to the Bureau and simply not get responses. That lack of transparency is a stumbling block and would make it challenging to make sure that money is getting used properly. But at the same time, aside from the staffing shortage, there are other very clear needs in the federal prison system. One of the ones that has sort of stuck with me ever since I've been, you know, talking to prisoners and officials about it over the past few months is, you know, there's one prison I cover where there was open feces just sort of flowing through part of the campus. And I mean, I think that's such a clear sewage and plumbing issue that should be fixed. And some of this is about not having staffing, and some of this is about not having adequate resources to tend to the massive number of people that we have incarcerated.
Joe, give us some more on this. You've made a compelling counterargument for me here, and I'm really like working to think through it. I want you to help me think through it some more about this question of if one is incarcerated, you want to feel safe while incarcerated. Tell me more about what it takes to create a circumstance of safety and of appropriate programming for those who are incarcerated.
It comes down to staffing and making sure that we got staffing. But when you have, like currently right now, with the lack of staffing, you have some officers that are what's called being mandated to work a double shift. Some of our officers, because of the lack of staffing, are working 64 to 75 hours a week. And obviously, when you work in that many hours, don't see your family. By the end of the week, you're not going to be alert. You know, and when you're not going to be alert, that's a serious security issue. Inmates who have time, they want to be safe as well. We do have a lot of predatory inmates that feed off the weaker inmates, you know, and it is our job to make sure everybody's safe. So with the security aspect, that's one. And then, of course, the programming. Programming is so important for these inmates, you know, whether you do, like I said, education, GEDs. We also have college courses that they can take, psychological counseling, you know, we got programming. So it's a trickle-down effect. So when we get the budgets, I think there's definitely, like Kerry was saying, we need oversight. Think about it. Right now, the Bureau of Prisons, we're the largest component in the DOJ. And our director is appointed, is not even confirmed. And there is absolutely no oversight. So, yeah, you can give us as much money as you want, but where is the money going to? And the rich get richer on top, and nothing goes down to the ground, to the prisons. It's a security issue. It's a programming issue. And look, every federal worker who works inside the Bureau of Prisons, we care. We want to run a prison safe. We want to run programs safe. We want these inmates, when they get out, to stay out and to hopefully get a job, to get a career, do something. We don't want recidivism. You know, we want them to be out there and be productive person of society. So it is a huge, huge, huge deal for all of us.
What difference does it make to have the educational programs?
It's a big deal. One of the things we do in education, like we have what's called a job fair, and we bring outside companies inside. If we know we have an inmate that's going to get out, we teach them basic skills. A lot of the inmates don't even have basic skills. So we teach them the basic skills. We teach them how to dress, how to talk, the posture, to prepare them to go out to the streets. And to get a GED, it is a big deal for these guys, or secondary education as well. Giving them a skill that they couldn't do you know, when they were in the street, at least when if they're going to be incarcerated, they can try to get a GED, try to get education. And maybe when they do get out, they could be a productive member of society.
Carrie Blakinger is a reporter at the Marshall Project, and Joe Rojas is president of the American Federation of Government Employees Union Chapter for the Correctional Officers in Central Florida. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for having me.